I'm Oliver Legg, co-founder of Asperon Search, and today on CyberBytes the podcast, welcome Erkang Zeng, CEO and founder of cyber asset analysis platform JupiterOne. Erkang gives an insight into how JupiterOne was founded whilst he was the CISO at Lyphomic and later spun into its own standalone entity. He also gives the raw insight into what 2023 was like from a founder's perspective. Enjoy the show.
Erkang, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me here. Very excited to be here and share some of the thoughts and insights and the journey.
Absolutely. And you've made me feel inadequate without a branded Asperon hat on. So I think I'll be on to our marketing team to get some updated merch.
Yeah, well, people do like the hat. So I figured I'll wear it and, show the spirit, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's only two security vendors that have made it onto the back of my laptop with their stickers, and you're one of them. So,
awesome. Yeah.
Generally defined by which logos I think my daughter will like the most.
Well, kudos to our marketing team and the designers. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, for the audience that don't know who you are and don't know who JupiterOne are, why don't you give a kind of high level overview of the business and what you founded JupiterOne to tackle?
Yeah, of course, right? So in a nutshell, JupiterOne is a cyber asset and attack surface management platform. And what that means, and that's a bit of a mouthful, it really means that in modern enterprises, everything is software defined, right? So everything from an HR record to a code repository to an application to the infrastructure to IT devices and networks and policies and identities and you name it, right? So the entire organization nowadays are digitized or software defined in some way. And the security is not just about IT anymore, right? So security is about protecting the entire business, the entire technology stack, the entire enterprise operations. So, and we all know that you can't protect what you can't see, or better yet, you can't protect what you can't understand, right? So the premises of JupiterOne is to then aggregate all of those software-defined assets and configurations and attributes into one place and connect the dots to make a massive network graph of how things are connected so that we can use like a data-driven way of analyzing and understanding the environment and the footprint, right? So that's what the cyber asset analysis platform is, right? So that's JupiterOne. Mm. And then a little bit of my own background, right? So I've been a former CISO at a life sciences software company, and I've been the head of software security at Fidelity Investments and run different global practices at IBM Security, right? So I've been a practitioner throughout the 20-something years of my career, pretty much all in cybersecurity and software engineering. And I actually built JupiterOne for a lot of my own pain points and challenges. And, you know, I wish I had a all-in-one data platform I can just go to and ask questions and get answers, right? And I couldn't find any. And then I decided to just build it. And then that became JupiterOne.
Yeah, awesome. And going back to that kind of the founding idea and then going ahead and actually launching JupiterOne, because I'm aware you were in stealth for a reasonable amount of time. It was about 2.5 years from my understanding. Was that just kind of going on the back in the background whilst you were still working your full-time day job, or did you kind of take the plunge and go 100% in on day one?
It was an interesting start, right? So it was a little bit of an unusual start, right? So it wasn't, I didn't quit a job and then, you know, go start this and raise money like most cybersecurity startups did, right? Now, instead, I built this internally at the previous company called Lyphomic, right? So when I was the CISO, and but instead of building the security function as a cost center, right? So the CEO and the founder of Lyphomic and I, we decided to build this into a innovation hub, right? So the product that became Jupyter One, started over there as an internal product, right? So that I built for my own operations. So it was a combination of both, actually, right? So I still had the full-time job of being a CISO and running the security operations in the program, but that program was backed by this product that we built internally, right? So Jupyter One. So you could say that, you know, we were actually full-time building Jupyter One, but we're also full-time running the program and the operations on top of this product that we built.
I guess there's no better way to test the product, right? Because you're kind of feeding it down to your security teams underneath you in real-time feedback.
So which, you know, arguably it took a little longer as a result, right? So, you know, and we were not necessarily in stealth, right? Like the usual, right? So usually being in stealth like 6 months, a year or so, right? So, you know, we were running internally for roughly for 2 years or a year and a half, 2 years. And then we actually, at the time, started going to market a little bit, right? So just right before the spinoff of creating Jupyter One officially, we had several early adopters and several customers that are kind of testing Jupyter One, right? Including Databricks, that was one of our very early customers that, you know, before Jupyter One was Jupyter One.
Yeah, awesome. And what are the complexities and how does it actually work from spinning that off into its completely own entity? Because as you say, most founders, they resign, they spend a few months building the products, they raise, and then they burst out of stealth. Whereas you built it almost for your employer at the time. So how does that work in terms of then spinning it off into its own
company? You know, and like everything in life, right? So there's two sides and there's the pros and cons, right? So, you know, of course, there's a lot of benefit of creating something internally that we become the first customer, that we're operationalizing it and we're using ourselves and so on and so forth, right? So there was no need to go raise funding, and it was internal, and you know, a lot of those became easier. Then you can kind of focus on building and operating, right? And but on the flip side, you know, there are definitely challenges, right? So because if you could imagine, right, so a typical startup raising money, then the founders and the VCs agree on terms, and you know, then off you go, right? But in this case, then not two party but three parties all have to agree on all of the terms and the cap tables and, you know, all the amount of investment and the structure and, you know, the whole thing, right? So then it just adds tremendous amount of complexity into the transaction itself, right? So I'll spare you the details, but I think that's sort of the other side of the coin, right? So there's the pros and the cons, but, you know, the good news is, you know, we've made it work, and, you know, it's a three-way win-win-win, right? So then, you know, if now thinking back, right, so there are many ways of starting a startup. I mean, you know, I'm not saying one is better than the other, right? So you just kind of have to understand the nuances and the pros and cons. And yeah, we've made it work, and, you know, I'm really excited that we got this far.
Yeah, well, you're here. What is it? Seven years later.
Six, right? If you include the 2 years at Lipomix, so almost 4 years since the spinoff.
Yeah, awesome. And you've always through other interviews and other kind of podcasts that I've seen, you've always got this very interesting reference and analogy back to the health sector. And you said a couple of interesting things on our kind of prep call for this as well, kind of comparing security buzzwords to antibiotics in the medical space. Talk me through the kind of mindset on security being very similar to the health sector.
Yeah. So a couple of things there. Right? So one is, you know, I don't know if you know, when growing up, I always wanted to be a doctor, or my family wanted me to be a doctor. And I ended up going to computer science, IT, and now cybersecurity, right? And, you know, I felt like, wow, that was I was going to be a super long journey to become a doctor, and I sort of chickened out, and I was like, you know, that's too much, right? But the funny thing is that now I'm doing cybersecurity. It feels like I've become sort of the doctor of the cyberspace, you know, and that's how I genuinely feel about this this domain or this function capability, right, or this discipline. You know, that's called cybersecurity, right? So a lot of times people think about cybersecurity, they think about the security people blocking them from doing some things and saying no, right? And that's the department of no, right? N-O. And you know, if you want your project dead in the water, go talk to the security guys, right? So that has been sort of the sentiment for a long, long time. Now, but recently, I believe the industry has shifted that mindset. And certainly I have, right? So shifted that mindset to feel like that the cybersecurity function for an enterprise, it really is not a policing function. I mean, it could be, right? So there are some elements of it, but it really is a wellness function, right? It's a caretaking function, it's a business enabling function, right? So instead of the security team being the department of no, N-O, it should be the department of no, like K-N-O-W, no, right? So, you know, if you want information, if you want knowledge, if you want to enable your team to go faster, well, you should collaborate with the security team to do that, right? And if you want to do it in a healthy way or in a less risky way, you should partner with your security team to do it. Mm-hmm. Right. So there are many analogies, right? So medicine is one of them. And the reason I use medicine is to say, you know, there are painkillers and there are antibiotics, there are drugs and medicines that addresses the symptoms, right? And then there are also medicines that addresses the root cause and to provide, you know, longevity of health. And I think you need both, right? It's not that you need one or the other. If you're sick, of course, you're not going to go take vitamins when you're sick, right? But you have to take the right drugs. But overall, right, if you don't pay attention to the wellness, the proactively, you know, whether it's vitamins or whether it's diet, whether it's exercise, then in the long run, you're doing yourself a disservice, right? Mm-hmm. So for your health. And I think the same thing applies to enterprise health and enterprise hygiene. So that's the reason I do the comparison. I think there's a lot of similarities and analogies we can draw from the physical world to the cyberspace.
Mm-hmm.
And another one I think you might have heard of, and that's not just me talking about it, is security is kind of like the brakes on a car, right? So for the cars to drive really fast, you don't just need the engines, right? The Formula One cars and whatever, NASCARs, right? Not only do they need super strong engines, those are the, you know, R&D teams and the product teams that are building stuff, right? So they can go fast, but you also need good brakes, right? You need the good protection, right? So that when something happens, you know, there's guardrails to protect you, right? So that's what cybersecurity is, proactively, right? So it's there. And it's better that you don't use it, right? It's better that you don't know it's there, but it is there in case you need it.
And I love your comparison to kind of the policing versus the kind of wellness function and the NO versus the KNOW. And I think if you were to say that to a lot of security folk and a lot of security founders, like they would completely get that. But their business may not be run with that kind of mindset flowing through it. So how does Jupiter One actually focus on that when the product's being built and the product's being delivered to enterprises? Kind of what are you doing to get that feeling of, well, we're the department of in the know rather than the department of no?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think this is honestly, still a challenge in the industry, right? And especially in today's macro economic environment, right? So because then, you know, if in the reality is most organizations are facing some degree of security challenges and issues, right? Whether they are large, complex organizations constantly getting attacked, or they are a new organization that are just getting started and building a program and trying to get their first compliance, or anywhere in between, those kind of two spectrums, right? So the challenge, of course, is that given very, very constrained resources and budget, and especially so in today's environment, then folks tend to focus more on the point solutions, right? They tend to say that, hey, what are those checkboxes that I have to check, right, in order to get, say, for that first compliance, or in order to stop an attack, an active attack from happening, right? So there's a lot of focus on that, right? So which then it makes transforming the program harder, or there's less budget, or there's fewer resources to truly focus on transforming the program so that you are in the long run operating more efficiently and effectively, right? So we are in the business to help organizations gain visibility, but optimizing and also transforming the program for the long run, right? So I think that in many cases, we talk to our customers and potential customers, and most of them are very excited about the vision that Jupyter One brings. And I think sometimes it's a matter of timing, right? So it's a matter of timing to say, hey, where on the journey am I, right? If I'm a CISO, where on the journey am I? And do I have the ability and the resources and the budget to focus on transforming the program, or do I have to get some of the foundation still sorted out, right? So the basics, right? Now, I would argue though, then I've seen this just in the past few years, right? So as I was, building Jupyter One and then this journey, I see that more and more security practitioners and security leaders are gravitating and seeing the Jupyter One approach to say that, once I have some of the day zero things, like I need malware protection, or I need encryption, I need single sign-on, I need, some of those things, right? So those are, you kind of have to have it, right? So without it, you can't really, run the business, right? So, once you have some of those in place, then you really got to focus on having deeper and more complete asset visibility, right? Because the more controls that you add on to the security program, the more complexity you also add, right? And the bigger the organization grows, the bigger the complexity. That just comes with the business, right? So at some point, and usually sooner than later, you have to start investing in that better visibility, right? Otherwise, and even if you pay for the best of breed, say XDR, CrowdStrike or SentinelOne or whatever, then you won't know what it doesn't know. So like, say CrowdStrike, right? So you say, well, I've bought CrowdStrike and I've rolled it out, I've deployed it. Now, how do you know out of the maybe 100,000 workloads and devices that every single one has the protection? Which ones do not? It's not going to tell you what it doesn't know, right? So you kind of need that more granular, more foundational level visibility that Jupyter One can provide, right? So I think we're seeing a lot of CISOs and security practitioners start seeing that and understanding that this visibility, this asset and configuration visibility, is the new foundation of a modern security program.
Yeah, awesome. And in the early days of Jupyter One's official formation, was it and especially with I guess your transition from security leader to now founder and CEO, was that an easy transition, or was it a bit of a shock in terms of all the new areas that you had to focus on and put effort into?
It certainly is both, right? So I would say that I've had a lot of learnings myself, right? So in this role, and I think for me, right? So fortunately, I have been at large organizations. I've run functions and large teams, and global teams, and so on, right? So have managed large budgets, and all those helped, right? So there's a lot of being a founder is very different than being a CEO, right? Especially as you grow and become a more larger or more sustainable business, right? So I think all of those, there's a lot of general leadership things that I've learned throughout my career that apply, right? But then also there are things that don't apply, right? So how you run a large team and a large organization compared to how you run a startup, and all aspects of a startup is actually very different, right? Even though, you understand all of the leadership principles, sometimes they apply really well. Sometimes they don't apply so well, right? In a startup. And, I have certainly learned a lot of hard lessons, and some of those are, shocking. And I say that very, very different challenges, right? In the early days of Jupiter One, compared to the challenges now, right? So as we are scaling the business. And I think that I don't know if you heard this term, right? So I feel like that we are, or myself has been transforming from the chief everything officer in the early days of a startup to the CEO, right? So the chief executive officer, right? So that sort of kind of sums it up, right? So you have to kind of make that transition, right? So you're not just in the weeds building and in every aspect of the business anymore, right? That was the early days, and now you have to rely on people and hold people accountable, having the right people in the right seats, and all of those, and make quick and hard decisions, right? So that's
it's a lot the of confidence to delegate as well, isn't it? And the confidence to fully hand certain bits of the role.
Exactly. And a lot of times, there's really, really hard decisions, right? So the tough part is there are kind of competing priorities, right? So there are, there's a reason to go this way, there's a reason to go that way. And there are like, separate directions and sometimes what's hardest is feels like then, but you have to make a decision, right? You have to make a decision, but sometimes you don't know if that in the moment, right? So you just couldn't really tell if that was the best decision that you could make, right? So I think that sometimes is part of, it comes with the job, right? The territory that, you almost never know if the decision you're making was actually the best.
Are there any of those kind of fork in the road moments that you wish you'd gone the other way that you'd be happy to share about?
I think so, right? So I think, just in the past year, I think a lot of companies, startups, tech companies, or just in general, right, has faced, tremendous economic pressure, right? So from the macro conditions. And we see, we've seen so many tech layoffs, right? So in the past year, and it continues to be so, right? So this year, right? So just in the first month and a half of 2024, we've seen so many. Now, we had to make those tough decisions as well, right? And last year we had, unfortunately, two rifts, and arguably the first one should have been a larger one so that we didn't have to do two, right? So I think that was a hard lesson. And I think that the folks who were being let go, of course, it's difficult and sad, right? So for all those folks. But then on the flip side, I don't think that people truly understand the difficulties of making those decisions at the leadership team, right? So with me and my executives and the board, right? So making those decisions is actually really, really tough. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, you want to save as many people as you can, right? So to you know, continuing to provide them with jobs and you know, compelling and exciting future, right? But on the flip hand, you have to balance that, you know, if we don't do the right things for the business, then, you know, everybody's going to be without a job, right? So then, you know, how do you best balance the two, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there's kind of forks in the road like that, right? So I wish I had done things a little differently. And also on the people side, you know, some of the key hires, some of them I wished I had had the key people in place sooner, right? So, you know, it's just, you know, some of those, right? So those are, I think the people side of things are probably the hardest decisions.
Well, they're harder to go back on as well, right? It's pretty definitive, but it's, I mean, look, last year was, I don't think there were many companies in the tech space and many other sectors as well that didn't feel the pinch of the macro economy. So it was an interesting year, but there was still, it's still refreshing to hear founders and CEOs actually talk about it, because it's, there seems to be this trend of just focusing on the success, focus on the growth, focus on the wins. So it's it is refreshing to hear people say, well, actually, no, this was tough. I didn't enjoy doing it.
I think so. Yeah, I think, you know, look, I appreciate you calling that out and saying that, right? Because, you know, this has been hard for me and probably many other founders and CEOs and just, you know, leaders in the industry, right? So, you know, we all see on LinkedIn and on social media that, hey, I just got a new round of funding. I just, you know, released new products and, you know, I just hired this amazing person and so on and so forth. So, of course, we want to share the excitement and the good news, and it up-levels the brand and all of those, right? But at the same time, I think then we then just trying to internalize and absorb all of the challenges and difficulties, and that becomes harder and harder over time. And I do think that, of course, there's this, you know, fear of oversharing, right? So then people may wonder, oh, what's going on with that company, right? So they continue to do layoffs, and, you know, are they stable? And, you know, and should we continue to partner with them, right? So that kind of things, right? So, you know, of course, I have the same concern and the same fear, right? But I say that I've always probably erred more on more transparency than others to gain trust. I think that is more important, right? So, and when we talk to our customers as well, right? So sometimes customers come to us and they say, hey, you know, you have the platform has more bugs and, you know, some instability and in certain areas. And same way, right? So we tend to be very transparent with the customers in talking about those things, right? So we don't want to shy away from the mistakes and errors that we've made, right? So I think that collectively, you know, with the right partnership in the community, you know, in the customer base, right? So we can get through anything, right? So we can continue to build, continue to grow, continue to innovate, right? Continue to do the best things for our customers and our teams.
Yeah. And I mean, coming back to the people piece, it's I think the compassion part is important. And if there's that complete lack of transparency, and like even you just then saying like it affected you, I think it makes you a person, and your employees will, and any prospect employees, they definitely respect compassionate leadership. Especially through the year everyone's gone through. So no, good stuff.
And even in the mix of all the challenges, right, I do think there's a lot of amazing things that the team had done, right? So we continue to have amazing customers, you know, sign up and you know, join the Jupiter One family. And you know, we have some very strong people that joined Jupiter One last year, right? Mm-hmm. You know, go-to-market leadership, technology leadership, and you know, customer success, and you know, all areas, right? And then we've released a lot of very compelling capabilities and features in the product, right? So we've done a lot of great work, you know, despite of all the challenges that we faced, mm-hmm. right? But I think that it's good for us to be able to talk about both sides in a more open and transparent way.
Mm. I mean, the reality of the sheer number of layoffs from such a wide variety of firms is that it then creates opportunities for both companies and the employees, because the employees are given a reason to look for their next great thing. And the companies are sometimes given the opportunity to hire people that they wouldn't necessarily have had the opportunity to a year before, which brings new ideas, which leads to new features, new customers, new growth. So
that's right. That's right.
Flip side to it.
It is. It certainly is, right? So I've seen many of our former J1ers do really well, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, whether that is landing great new opportunities somewhere, or in some cases, a few of them even went out and created their own startup, right? Mm-hmm. So we're really excited to see their continued growth, right, beyond or after their journey at Jupiter One, right? Yeah. So nobody stays at one place forever, right? So I think it's great to see those. And at the same time, right, so this allowed us as a company to see, you know, where we could operate more efficiently and, you know, where we could use new ideas and, you know, new folks, right, coming in, right? So it's just, as you said, right, it creates opportunities on both sides.
Absolutely. And I mean, where are we? We're kind of coming to the end of month two of 2024. So what's in store for J1 this year? What can people be excited to see from you guys?
Yeah, there are a lot of very exciting things coming up for J1. And a lot of those are in the various product improvements, right? So I would say. And as a platform, right? So Jupiter One has from day one been built as a data platform and analytical platform, right? So there are a lot of new architectural changes that are super exciting to empower, enable more innovation on top of that, right? So it will, you know, be a lot more enterprise scale. It will be a lot more scalable, performant, and, you know, all of those, right? So we're shooting for, you know, not just five nines, right, in, you know, reliability and scalability and so on. We're shooting for 100%, right? So I think, you know, us being a data platform, you know, my new CTO, Josh, right, so keep saying it, right? So even 0.001% of data inaccuracies is significant, right? So in the amount of data that we're processing, right? So we're shooting for 100%, right? So we're making transformative changes in the platform and architecture. And, you know, this would allow us to unlock capabilities like AI and machine learning and consolidation of, you know, different capabilities on top of it, right? So we will be able to provide better and more accurate vulnerability prioritization, more, you know, risk-based, context-based risk analysis, right? And then much easier continuous compliance, you know, natural language-driven, you know, questions and answers, right? So a lot of those things that are already in process, or we'll see come to fruition this year.
Exciting stuff. Well, looking forward to seeing it all happen. And also looking forward to hopefully seeing another huge inflatable spaceman at RSA and Black Hat this year as well, if he'll be blessing his presence.
We hope you've enjoyed this latest episode of Cyberbytes.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Please give it a thumbs up, subscribe, and tell your friends. If you want to explore being a guest or how Aspiron Search can help you build high-performing security and go-to-market teams, then get in touch on LinkedIn.
Well, okay, thank you so much for coming on. Looking forward to following Jupiter One's journey even further.
Sounds good. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah.